Well, I'm going to ask you some questions about habitations of the word, and I also want to ask some questions about yourself. Are you from Ohio?
I grew up in Ohio.
Tell me about that. Where were you born?
Warren, Ohio. It's a steel town near Youngstown, and just south of Cleveland. It was a town which I later realized was inadequate because it didn't have a college. That's civilizing necessity. Town where a great deal of violence took place in the Depression when the steel mills and so on were closed, and I remember mostly that sort of thing about it, the Depression time.
What did your parents do?
My father was a school teacher, taught drafting, architectural drawing and so on in a high school. And my mother was just a housewife.
Just,
that's what you have to say now.
Well, your father sounds like a person with a great deal of practicality, being a draftsman and teaching drafting. Is that what
you're
teaching?
Yes, drafting. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, how did this academic love of yours rub off?
Well, I don't know. He never approved of it very much. He was trained himself as an architect, and then. During the First World War and a flu epidemic, had emphysema and empyema and I don't know what all, and I took a lot of his back out, and so he couldn't work over a drafting table. The world was spared a bad architect, I think, though. And so he started to teach, but he was an athlete as well, and he wanted me to be an athlete, and that was a sad hope. So my career as an academic was very foreign to him.
Were you a reader as you grew up?
Yes, very. What constantly.
What influenced you as a young person reading?
Well, I read everything and anything that came to hand. I, at the same time, would be reading dime novels I was very fond of. The Shadow and things like that back in those days. And at the same time, it might have been someone put a copy of The French Revolution by Carlyle, and I'm reading The Shadow and The French Revolution, and it's all the same to me. Everything, absolutely indiscriminate. In that city, there weren't any bookstores of any sort, but the pocketbooks were just coming into existence. And so I would save up all my money and buy. I bought all of them as they came out. It didn't matter if it was Etiquette, I bought that, or if it was H.G. Wells' Outline of History, I bought that, and I just read them.
Boy, those paperbacks really changed our reading habits.
Oh, it was incredible. Yes, a quarter. Pocketbooks. Had little cellophane wrappers on them. I have still some left.
Yeah, the kangaroo. That's
right.
Picture of the kangaroo in the upper corner. Yeah. We all read paperback books. I did, and of course, when my more formative years in the 1950s. And believe it or not, I have some that seem to be very valuable these days because I've held on to them. Books by Capote and Ray Bradbury. The Valentine books came out with originals in the 1950s.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they would publish simultaneously the hardcover and the paperback. And so, of course, I couldn't afford the $2 hardcover. It seems like that wouldn't be very much money, but it was.
Yes. Yeah.
What about school? Were you a good student?
Yes, I always did fairly well. I had my miserable subjects in mathematics. But I did well in school, yeah.
English, I suppose, was your...
Yes, though I avoided English after I got to college because I always quarreled with the teachers and thought I knew everything. And so I found that it was wise to take courses where you felt you really needed the help of the instructor. And so I didn't take any English courses in college at all, really.
Where did you receive your higher education?
I went to Kenyon College in Ohio first, and then Cornell for my doctorate.
Mm-hmm. Kenyon certainly has a literary tradition. Who was there? Was it John Crow Ransom?
John Crow Ransom. And,
Lowell was there?
Lowell. An enormous number, a fine poet now, Anthony Hecht, was there. And, of course, a number of writers who have come from from there. Dr. O is a Kenyan graduate.
Dr. O?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And there's the man who just completed this massive biography of Thomas Merton teaches there.
Mott. Michael Mott.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just had him in a while back to talk about that. And, of course, Kenyon is known for the its literary review.
Kenyon Review. Mm-hmm.
That was a good place for you.
Yes, it was. It was a bad time, though. It was during the war, and so we were kept out of English courses and put in navigation and things like that.
What happened after college?
Well, I was in the Navy for 3.5 years, and then when I came back and got my bachelor's degree, I went to Cornell and got a Ph.D. and started teaching at the College of Worcester, which is in Ohio, too.
A Ph.D. in English?
In philosophy.
In philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And you taught at Worcester?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How long were you there?
About 4 years, and I went to Purdue, where I stayed for 16, I guess, about, before I moved on to Washington University, where I am now.
How long have you been at Washington now?
About 15, let's see, I came in 69.
I'm bemused to a degree in reading some of the reviews of the critics who are confounded as to whether or not you are a novelist, a critic, a philosopher, or maybe you're a little bit of everything.
Well, I teach philosophy, but I have always claimed not to be a philosopher at all. I think that is a terribly difficult occupation. If you have six, say, first-rate philosophers in a century, you call it the Age of Enlightenment. There are lots of novelists and poets in history. Very few philosophers are remembered. I think that it's the most difficult thing I know, well enough to know how difficult it is, that is. And so I don't pretend to do any creative philosophizing. I love to teach it because it is a very exciting subject, but that's not the same as producing in it. The same problem with literary criticism, the number of critics that are any good, who really last, who you go back to, like one does to T.S. Eliot or Arnold or back further to Coleridge and so on, they're just a handful compared to all the poets and so on. And I take this to be a sign, empirically, that it's a much harder job to be really good at it. And one of the things I'm struck by, as one reads, say, Eliot again, or Arnold, or go back as far as Coleridge, is that if you are a good critic, you're good because you also write with great authority. It's the style of the mind that's involved. And that all these other people who are turning out huge amounts of stuff every year in English departments, that all just disappears. And I think probably just as well.
Yes, in Habitations of the Word, especially, I've noticed that you use novelistic devices in your language. And I think that's important in writing criticism, if you want to call it that, or essays, as you put it. Material like that can be dry. Alfred Kazin is another person who writes extremely well. I mean,
yes.
I can just see him turning his... he also turns out to be a next-door neighbor of mine.
Uh-huh.
And I can see him turning out a fiction. He has never done that, but
yeah.
I can see him doing that. You have, indeed. Yeah.
Well, Alan Trilley did, too. He wrote fiction, as well as Edmund Wilson did. To a certain extent, for such people, can only speak, I guess, for myself, writing is writing. That is, the problem of writing, of getting sentences put together properly, is overwhelming, whether you're trying to give an exposition of an idea or a narration of an action. They are, in fact, parallel problems. And my breaking up of narration is paralleled in my essays by the breaking up of exposition. In the one case, you're really trying to develop what's inherent in an idea, in the essay, and in the story, in a character or a situation you start. And in both cases, you kind of have exfoliation, of a growth out of the initial situation. That's why I prefer essays to, as I say in the book, articles. Essay follows the train of thought, where it may lead, and becomes then a development that has its own fictional counterpoint. What will happen to this idea, you know? Will it meet somebody nice? And so I find a great deal of parallel between the two activities.
Let's go back a little bit to your first book. That was a novel, wasn't it?
Yes, Almost Better's Luck. Well, it was a book that took me, again, as usual in my work, a long time to write, 10 years.
What year was that published?
That was published in 1966.
And the title?
Almond Setter's Luck. And it had a great deal of difficulty finding a publisher. This is a common story. The most striking thing about, I suppose, that first novel was the fact that while I was writing the last chapter, the manuscript was stolen.
You had another copy, I hope.
No. I had notes, of course, and drafts and things of that sort, but no copy. So I had to rewrite it.
How would that be stolen?
I was on my desk in my office at Purdue University while I went out to give a lecture. I had it there working on this last chapter. And when I came back, it was gone. And
who in the world would steal someone's manuscript?
At the university at the time, we had a professional a stealer of manuscripts, or a ranger who had stolen other articles and published them under his own name in the English department. He tried to publish or rewrite the novel as a play, and some people, by that time I had published parts of it, people recognized it. He had lots of devices. He was quite extraordinary. He would pretend to be editing an anthology, in this case, say, of the work of West or Catherine Ann Porter. And he asked me to write an essay on Catherine Ann Porter for this anthology. I was delighted to do so and wrote the essay, which he later published in Southwest Review. So he finally had to leave the country. The last I heard, he was in South America. That's many years ago.
So was he brought up on charges at Purdue?
No, he left before. He never stayed any place more than 1 year. And before I had any proof that this was the man who had done it, though I had sort of an inner feeling from the first, he was gone, you know. But he published a number of things. He published articles on West and so on, and all written by other people.
That's incredible. I don't see how anybody would even want, under his own name, to publish somebody else's work.
Well, he led a life based on this subterfuge. He was a compulsive liar. He couldn't tell the truth about anything. So if you asked if he told you what how old he was, he wouldn't be off by much. A year or two, but it would never be true. I mean, he couldn't do it. He didn't even prepare his own lectures.
I'm at the age where I'm doing that also. I'm always off a little bit. Never quite accurate about the age. Well, I guess since that time, you make sure that your manuscripts are well locked.
Yes, I do. I do. Now, that was quite an experience. The worst part of it was after that, because I worked very hard in a kind of state of total shock, and I'd been working on this novel for 7 years or so, and rewrote it, and I thought it was better, so that in a sense, this unfortunate event, I thought had improved the book. And then I set the manuscript aside for about 6 months, as is a habit of mine.
To sigh?
I set it aside.
Oh, aside.
Yes, for about 6 months, to let it sort of go stale. And looked at it again, and that was a terrible experience, because I realized it was a terrible book and wouldn't do. So I had to start all over.
It did all right, though. It went into more than one printing.
Oh, yes, when it was finally published. But I had rewritten it that final time, and it was quite a different book than one I'd been working on.
Well, I was reading Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife, which I think came out...
68.
And I had... what is this book all about?
I
had trouble with it. It's so funny, and I found myself laughing, and then the way you have the words printed on the page, the different type setting. Here it's not even, the pictures, the list and everything. And I found myself chuckling and enjoying it as I read it, but not totally understanding it. And I remember reading in the New York Times Sunday Magazine several years ago an article with John Gardner.
Yeah.
In which he took you to task. He said something to the effect... he accused you of wasting the greatest genius ever given to America, which is, if you're going to criticize somebody, you might as well preface it with something like that, by fiddling around when you could be doing important things. Essentially, I think what he was saying, you played games with words.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Tell me about Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife, and indeed, are you playing games, in your fiction at least, with words?
Well, people use the we, and indeed I do too, play, but not games. A play is serious. Games are often not serious. Play is an activity. What I think all creative people are really trying to do is to explore the medium. Now, this particular book is, in fact, a unification, really, of novelistic or fictional impulses and essay impulses. And it was written as a manifesto, artistic manifesto. And the metaphor of the book is that language is for the purpose of this metaphor, language is feminine, must be courted. This would bother feminists now, I suppose, but must be courted, must be... made love to properly. The woman who is the object of the title Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife is a woman of bad morals, much misused by men. What I wanted to do was to suggest that that was also the case with language. So I wanted an identity between the nature of language and the nature of this character. And I did it in order to make pronouncements, I guess, about the nature of art. John and I have had disagreements about this for years. I simply regard my seriousness, I suppose, as inside a clown suit, whereas I think he felt... that was the wrong garb. So this is a very playful book.
It's a romp.
Yeah. But it has, I hope, a very serious point to make. And it's a point, I think, about the superiority of the importance of language itself over the objects to which they refer and so on and so forth. The conceptual side of language, in other words.
You remind me, in many respects, of John Barth, who has a very inventive use of language in his last novel, which was Sabbatical. Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to read that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where he uses a narrator. Actually, two people are narrating it simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's possible. I mean, how can you have a dual narrator for a single story? And he got away with it. And it actually turned out to one of the best... one of his best books, I thought.
Yeah. Well, of course, Barth is, certainly one of our, if not our best writer, a genius, I think, myself. And he can do anything he wants. and does.
Well, you're doing pretty much what you want as well. You had mentioned that the novel, Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife, was a metaphor... But then you state in Habitations of the Word that a novel in itself any novel is a metaphor for life. Now, is that,
yeah.
is that, well, tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a double situation there. There's a novel itself is a, has a metaphorical relationship to the world it describes, I think.
Why can't it just tell a story?
Well, the kind of story it tells, what it chooses to depict, what it leaves out, makes it no longer really an accurate depiction of things, but rather a model or metaphors, I prefer, of reality. What happens is that you see the rest of the world. It's as if you had made a lens through which you see the world. But that lens cannot and does not take in everything. It reshapes things. Then you see everything through it, and that's fine. That can be very interesting. But that also means that every novel provides you with a different model. Sometimes they're quite similar to one another, but often quite different. So I pick up Beckett, and I see a whole my life. Oh, I'm living in a garbage can, I realize, and so on. And I see everything that way. And then I put that down, and I pick up Tolstoy, and I'm in another world. Each one is providing a perfectly, I think, legitimate perception in that fashion of the world. I don't raise question about which one is right.
Mm-hmm. In your book of essays, you also write of a sentence as a soul.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? How can a sentence have a soul?
What I'm talking about is how sentences will carry on the course of a number of human faculties. First of all, a sentence is a length of thought. There are a set of ideas that unfold. The sentence usually involves a perception of the relationships of things in the world as well. Then the question is, sentences have energy. They have direction. They have passion. And my notion is that you can, in fact, see all of these qualities, which are qualities of people's character and consciousness. What I'm suggesting is that the really good sentences are the sentences in which, indeed, just as with people, we recognize them as individuals, as bearing the stamp of a particular nature. My favorite examples, of course, are someone like Henry James. We look at a sentence and we say, that's James. How is it? Well, James is there. In fact, that's the only place he is now, is in his sentences. That personality, that way the mind works, that kind of scrupulosity, kind of precision, of definition, care that James gives to everything and the way his mind works, those things, it seems to me, are the real heart of writing and what make good writing as opposed to anonymous, soulless stuff that could be written by anybody or a machine. And indeed, I think machines will take over a lot of that.
I think one of your funniest essays was the one about and. I hadn't thought about the word and until I read that. And I didn't know there was so much to say about it. But it turns out, it also occurred to me as I read the article that you could write a whole novel in one continuous sentence. You never have to stop, because between every thought, all you have to do is put an and.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
And never stop. Tell me a little bit mm-hmm. about and why that word seems to be so important in our language.
Well, I think it's one of the things that struck me and led me to write this essay is that there are a lot of little lost words of, in, and, connectives that are extraordinarily important to logicians, in which I've studied in a lot of logic, and yet tend to be forgotten, and which perform enormous numbers of services, almost invisibly. And in one essay I wrote in an earlier book, I was investigating the nature of the word of, and the difference between uniforms of the band and fingers of the hand, for instance. And I was struck by the fact that although the structure of those phrases is exactly the same, we don't interpret the of in both cases as the same relationship, in which case we really have trouble getting the uniforms off the band and laundering them and so on. And how was that? How did that happen? And I tried to figure out how we take our knowledge of the world and our knowledge of that uniforms belong to the body and the band differently than the fingers do, to fill in and interpret the words. And so I went to the word and, which appears verbally in the same light over and over, and yet we give it dozens of different meanings, quite sophisticated ones, immediately and without any trouble. It's a miraculous device, and really a clue to the way language itself works. Because and appears in all these different contexts and means somewhat differently in each context, and yet we have no trouble picking it up. And that's because we bring to these contexts the things that and is binding together in each case. An enormous knowledge of the world, which immediately someone says cabbages and kings. Well, we know how that and is working because we know what cabbages and kings are. The and doesn't tell us anything. We fill it in each time. And so much so that we can't simply carry on that relationship between cabbages and kings to the next time and appears, because it may have a very different meaning, even completely contradictory meaning. So I got very fascinated about that. I think that studying a word like that enables you to realize how amazing those linguistic moves are and how much we bring to them and how sophisticated our reading is.
What's going to be your next target? It?
But? I may. I was thinking about doing in, but...
How about out?
Yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time. Another essay that I particularly liked was the one on speed reading. You said something very interesting in there. I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but I think you said as one speed reads, he looks for literary landmarks in the... Is that the way you phrased
it? Yes, landmarks, yeah.
Because that's true. I do so much reading because my broadcast runs 5 days a week. And I usually talk to people like yourself 2, 3, 4 times a week sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of reading to do. And so I read fast, and I tend to do that. I tend to look for things that pop out at me,
sure.
And then I fill in the blanks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, though, that's a very effective way of reading fiction. Fiction, it seems to me, is the kind of writing that has to be devoured.
Well, I agree. I think that I can read very rapidly still, and I use it to gut books and find this and that I need from it in a particular time. But to read the finer literary people, say, you really have to, ideally, we never have the time for it, but we really have to say them to ourselves. James, just to use his example again, has to be played in the head. He becomes immediately clear, for one thing, marvelously resonant, but who's going to sit down and really do that? So we start to speed up and move a little faster. But that's like speeding up Mozart. And I mean, we get to the end faster, but you really never quite hear the music. And the music is a major part of it. The pace. One of the things I try to point out in the book is the fact that we don't even perform the rests. We see a comma, say, and we know that that means, among other things, a pause. And so we conceptually pause, but our eye keeps right on going just as fast as ever. With someone like Beckett, for instance, you must pause. You have to perform the pauses. Otherwise, the tension of the silences doesn't get to you. And in one of his books, which is a favorite of mine, How It Is, you have to pant, till you hyperventilate between the broken phrases. And it's true, the demands that the writer makes for such performances, we no longer have the time, generally, to do. That once upon a time, Flaubert finish a book, he'd drag his friends in and read the whole thing to them, and they'd sit there and suffer, of course. And in the old days in America, people read the Bible aloud all the time, and a great part of our verbal resources in the literary world comes from that tradition. But rarely do we do it anymore, and it's a great loss. Faulkner, one of the great things about Faulkner is that he's still hearing those verbal recitations, and he has to be recited as well. But it really slows you down, and it makes you then think, how do I intone this sentence? What actual pauses? So I'm the conductor. I have to arrange, and then I have to play all the instruments. Then you begin to understand what the work is about, and I think not until.
Well, William Gass, you described yourself as, as one who contracted verbal disease, and I look upon that as a very positive assertion. Thank goodness that you did for our sake, and thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. You're a young person. Do they still use the term, it's a gas? it's still in the common vernacular?
I haven't heard it in a long time.
Well, if it's not, you are a gas, William Gass, and thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure, indeed.